It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up after 5:30, we'll look at how the Pulitzer Prize, which was yesterday awarded for reporting on the NSA's surveillance program, may influence public perception of both the NSA and whistleblower Edward Snowden. But first, it's been 1 year since three people were killed and more than 260 injured in the Boston Marathon bombing.
On this anniversary, we ask whether the United States is better equipped to respond to, if not prevent, domestic terrorism and why it happens in the first place.
Brian Jenkins is with us. He's senior advisor to the RAND Corporation president and author of No Path to Glory, Deterring Homegrown Terrorism. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, a year after the Boston Marathon bombings, what can we confidently say we learned from the experience in the way of deterring domestic terrorism?
Well, you know, we look at every single plot that's uncovered or attack that occurs to see what we can distill in terms of how we handled intelligence, how we handled the aftermath of the incident. Could it have been prevented? Could the response have been better? We have learned a number of lessons. The Inspector General's report from the Department of Justice was critical of the initial investigation and interview of the elder Sarnib brother, which had been motivated by the lead provided by the Russian authorities, although the IG report does not claim that the act could have been prevented, but they were critical. There was also criticism that the FBI, after it had conducted the interview, did not share any of the information with the Boston police. This is still an area which is difficult to deal with. It's not just a matter of sharing information, but there are some genuine concerns about privacy and civil liberties. Insofar as the response generally is regarded as having been handled extremely well. And one extraordinary thing that comes out of it is the degree of public engagement after the bombing occurred by the people of Boston in sharing their video material and quickly identifying the perpetrators, going along with a controversial lockdown, and indeed providing the tip that led ultimately to the apprehension of the second brother.
Mm. Did we learn more about why the threat of this attack and the lead up to the execution of it fell through the cracks in terms of the federal and local intelligence that might have been able to catch it ahead of time?
Well, you know, look, the record of domestic intelligence thus far has been remarkable. There have been, since 9/11, 43 homegrown terrorist plots motivated by jihadist ideology in this country. Of those 43 plots, the authorities have uncovered and thwarted 39 of them. Of the remaining four, three resulted in fatalities: the shooting in Fort Hood, a shooting in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the Boston bombing. Now, unfortunately, 20 people still died as a result of these attacks, and those are 20 tragedies. But a record of uncovering 39 potential attacks out of a total of 43 is an enviable record. No one believes that we're going to get it right every single time.
And terrorism tactics continue to evolve with time. They get more cunning, more sly, more innovative. How does that affect the way in which one can outsmart the terrorists, for lack of a better phrase? Do you have any insight as to how law enforcement and the FBI and other agencies try to stay on the cutting edge?
Well, first of all, the problem hasn't been that the terrorist plots that we've seen and even the attacks have been carried out by cunning and technically sophisticated people. Most of the attacks have been very amateurish. That is not to say that they have not been, on occasion, lethal. But it's not a matter of the skills of the terrorists. It's something else. 68% of these plots that have been uncovered involved a single individual. The remaining plots were tiny conspiracies. In the case of the Boston bombing, two brothers. There's no underground army of sleepers to penetrate. There's no terrorist group with an ongoing campaign to penetrate. These are one-off attacks, mostly by individuals or, in other cases, by tiny conspiracies. That's a real challenge for intelligence. We don't have X-rays for a man's soul. We don't have the kind of secret intelligence apparatus that can that is so omnipresent and so omniscient that we can pick up every single one of these attacks. So that's the real challenge here.
Right, and if you ask someone on the street, describe a terrorist for me, you know, who do you picture? You might hear a lot of stereotypical descriptions, jihadists, Muslims, that sort of thing. How accurate is that, though?
Well, first of all, the domestic terrorist threat in the United States is more diverse than simply those motivated by Al-Qaeda or other jihadist ideologies. In fact, individuals who were motivated by white supremacism or other hateful ideologies on the extreme right have been responsible for over 30 deaths in the same period of time that I spoke about the 20 deaths caused by the jihadists. So, in fact, some of these other sources have been deadlier. We still do have some occasional actions or plots by anarchist terrorists in this country. As I say, we have those on the extreme right and those motivated by Al-Qaeda's ideology. They account for the bulk of the threat. Insofar as our profile of a typical terrorist, if we put aside, you know, the members of the Ku Klux Klan or white supremacist groups, if we look at the jihadists for a moment, in terms of income level, in terms of educational level, they are not there that different from the profile of other males in the same age bracket. That is, if we compare them to similar age males in terms of the level of college education, level of income, we find a fairly diverse population. Some are high school dropouts. Some have postgraduate degrees. Some of them are really in the lower economic levels in terms of earnings. Others, in fact, economically were doing quite well. So there's not a... It's not as if that they are all wearing the same clothes, or that they're all from the, you know, theoretically oppressed. In fact, even when we begin to look at motives, we find that, to be sure, ideology, religious faith in the case of the jihadists, plays a role. But the most critical factor seems to be personal crisis. And in that sense, some of these ideologies merely have become conveyors for individual discontents.
It's interesting to me that you single out, or you make the distinction that these people are men. I know you're not a sociologist, but could you just break that down just a little bit and tell me whether, you know, law enforcement individuals or other resources in our society have latched onto that and are trying to address it?
Well, in terms of the groups that represent a potential terrorist threat right now, the fact is that they are overwhelmingly male. If we look at the jihadists who have been arrested since 9/11, there are a handful of women in that, either arrested for having knowledge which they did not share with the federal authorities, or misleading a federal authorities in the course of an investigation. In some cases, involved in propaganda or material support activities, but at least among the jihadists, the perpetrators have been almost exclusively male. On the other end of when we look at some of these extreme right-wing groups, there again we see that at least among the perpetrators that have been identified, an overwhelmingly male population. It was different in the 1970s and 1980s when in some of the far left-wing groups like the Weather Underground or some of the others where women played a more prominent role, but I'm afraid the jihadists and the white supremacists tend to be male chauvinists.
Mm. We're talking with Brian Jenkins of the RAND Corporation about the threat of domestic terrorism on this one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. We hope you'll join the conversation. Do you believe that domestic terrorism is still a real threat today? Do you feel any safer on account of some of the lessons we might have learned from previous attacks here in the U.S.? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Brian Jenkins on this one-year anniversary of the bombings at the Boston Marathon. Brian's the author of No Path to Glory, Deterring Homegrown Terrorism. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well. What concerns you most about the threat of domestic terrorism today? Do you feel safer or not since the attacks in Boston a year ago? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, or you can also comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Brian, one element of, public discourse that usually is born out of these attacks and milestones in our history, especially 9/11 and starting after 9/11, is the issue of civil liberties and personal privacy and that sort of thing. And yet, what stands out to me about the Boston attack was that one crucial element in identifying the attackers was the use of public video surveillance cameras that were, I believe they were part of the city of Boston's street surveillance system. And did that stand out to you? And do you see a year later maybe more acceptance, more understanding of the use of these systems and a willingness to sacrifice personal privacy?
Well, let's make a distinction for a moment between the cameras, which have become a standard feature in a lot of public places, and other concerns about privacy. The fact is that there is a question, a legitimate question, as to what are the expectations of privacy in a public place. Lawyers argue about this, but the fact is we certainly have seen, not just since Boston, but as a long-term trend, the proliferation of closed-circuit television cameras. And these have proved to be valuable in dealing with both ordinary crime and more rarely in dealing with cases of terrorism. They are less a deterrent, it appears, but are more valuable in providing information that can lead to the apprehension of individuals. And that has some utility because we know, for example, in the case of the Boston bombers, that they were, had they not been apprehended, they would have gone on to continue their campaign. They already had bombs constructed to do so. So the intervention by the authorities, which was enabled by the footage from these cameras, did provide a valuable result. We've also seen, because of technological developments, the proliferation of cameras in the hands of every individual who has a cell phone, and we're looking ahead to devices that will be deployed, which will provide extraordinary powers through these so-called glasses that one can wear, and really raise new questions about privacy. So all of these are being debated. At the same time, there is a very serious debate going on about some of the programs that were being carried out by the government involving the monitoring of metadata from phone calls and internet traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And this has raised some real issues, and it is important to address these. Overall, I think it would be incorrect to say that civil liberties have been savaged since 9/11. I don't think that's the case. But as a consequence of new legislation, new laws, new programs, new assertions of executive authority in the federal government, we have put into place really the foundation for a much more oppressive state. We could, if sufficiently frightened, or if there was a less benign leadership in Washington, very quickly alter the relationship between government and the people. And in that sense, we're dancing on the edge of tyranny here.
I wanted to bring up the Harvard report. I don't know if you're familiar with that came out earlier this month, looking back at how the response of the multiple agencies came together. According to this report, this bomb response exposed, quote, fault lines in policing. That is to say that the communications systems, sort of, there was no coordinated system in terms of communication and resting. There were a lot of overtired officers, and there's an allegation that at least one officer might have been shot by another accidentally, although it's never been formally corroborated. What takeaways should we hold as a result of some of these things that happened in Boston last year?
In terms of the response, overall, one would have to say that the coordination of responses has become much better in recent years, in the years since 9/11, where we've been devoting more attention to this, as a consequence not simply of terrorism, but of some of these terrible shooting events that we have seen take place in various parts of the nation. Each of these incidents has called for a coordinated response by the emergency responders, by the police, in some cases from several jurisdictions. And so we've gotten better at that, unfortunately, as a result of a lot of practice. Is this still a work in progress? Are there still shortcomings? I don't know, honestly, that I have seen a single after-action report that did not point to problems in communication between police and emergency responders, or between various police departments in a multi-jurisdiction case. That just seems to be one of these chronic problems that we deal with, and apparently it's somewhat complicated. If it weren't so doggone complicated, I think they would have fixed it by now. So communications are a chronic problem. We just had a report recently that looked at a shooting at the Los Angeles airport. And there again, issues of communications came to the top in terms of one of the problems. With regard to tired policemen,
Brian, I'll jump in just for a moment here and say you've got 30 seconds.
All right. You know, again, chronic policemen, that's that again, in these long episodes, that can always be a problem. We don't have a solution to that.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Brian Jenkins, senior advisor to the RAND Corporation president and author of No Path to Glory, Deterring Homegrown Terrorism, talking with us about the current threat of domestic terrorism today.
Coming up, the Pulitzer Prize was awarded to the Washington Post and the Guardian yesterday for their coverage of the NSA surveillance program. How will the prize affect public perception of the NSA and whistleblower Edward Snowden? It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an Afghan writer about his experiences growing up during the many wars and transitions in his home country that his home country has seen in the past few decades.
But first, yesterday the Washington Post and the Guardian's U.S. wing won the Pulitzer Prize for public service for their coverage of the National Security Agency's surveillance activities after last year's bombshell disclosures from former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
There had been a lot of speculation over whether the Pulitzer would be awarded for the controversial stories of how the NSA had secretly collected millions of Americans' phone records and internet data. Michael Calderon joins us. He's the senior media reporter at the Huffington Post. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Michael, there was a lot of buzz in the past weeks about whether the Pulitzer Board would take this step, which many see as a courageous one, if not provocative. Just how surprising is this to you?
Well, you know, the NSA coverage and the reporters and news organizations involved with it have won a number of prestigious awards. Just this past Friday, Glenn Greenwald and others who were involved with the coverage from The Guardian and also from The Washington Post won the prestigious Polk Award. But there was still speculation about whether the Pulitzer Committee would honor them, because the Pulitzer Committee would be making quite a statement. And I think they did this in giving the award, especially for public service. They're making a statement that these disclosures were in the public interest, and this is what journalists and editors have been arguing all along, even as you have members of government and officials and some members of Congress suggesting otherwise, that these disclosures were not in the public interest and actually damaged national security.
For listeners who may not be so familiar with the story, would you mind recapping it for us?
Sure. I mean, the Guardian, which is a British newspaper, has a U.S. Newsroom as well. And it was actually, they broke the initial story in June of 2013. And at that time, we didn't know who Edward Snowden was. But the initial story was about Verizon and how the NSA had been sweeping up millions of Americans' phone records. And this is the first story broke. And then the second day, within 24 hours, the Washington Post and the Guardian had two more bombshell stories about how the NSA, the National Security Agency, was sweeping up internet data and was getting a direct line to a number of different major companies like Google and Yahoo. And, so this got the ball rolling, and it was a couple days later that The Guardian, through Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, who's a filmmaker, they helped Edward Snowden reveal himself to the world. And Edward Snowden, by this time, was in Hong Kong, and he revealed that he was the leaker of these documents. And Edward Snowden now remains in Moscow and has been charged with crimes under the Espionage Act here in the U.S. So, it started with a couple big stories, and it just snowballed. And the stories aren't over, because now you have the New York Times has some documents. Other outlets around the world have documents, and Glenn Greenwald, who is the journalist who was at The Guardian and has since left to help start his own media company, he's saying that some of the biggest, most complex stories are still to come.
Does this, the Pulitzer for this was given in the category of public service, and I'm wondering if that sends a message about the purpose, the mission of journalism and what it's meant to do. Does it send that message?
I think it does. The Public Service Award is a really significant one. I mean, in the past, NSA reporting has sometimes fallen under national reporting. For instance, the New York Times reported in 2005 on the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program, and that was a bombshell story. And similar to the NSA disclosures more recently, got a lot of criticism, suggestions that the New York Times was you know, acting as a traitor or had damaged national security. You know, that went under national reporting. And so one of the questions leading into the Pulitzers was both, A, would the Pulitzer Committee honor the NSA coverage? And if they did, how would they do it? Would it be specific reporters? Would it be for a reporting category? Would it be for public service? So I think by giving it in public service and giving it to both The Guardian and The Washington Post, because they were really at the forefront of all this, I think it makes a real statement that this reporting and that this coverage and these revelations are truly in the public interest and have sparked a really important debate worldwide about privacy and surveillance.
Snowden himself declared it a vindication upon hearing the news of this award. And I'm wondering how this public debate over his actions have him declared both a hero and a traitor. How will this award affect his image in the public eye?
You know, I don't know. I think a lot of people are pretty set on how they see him. Like you said, people, you know, clearly think that he is a traitor for what he did. He leaked classified documents to journalists, and he left the country, and now he's in Russia, a country that clearly the U.S. is at odds with over a number of different issues. And so, you know, I don't think it's going to change those people's minds. And for people who see him as a hero and really feel that he, you know, what he did was beneficial, so that people would actually have a better understanding of the government's seizing of their data, you know, how the government takes their data and how the government uses it and or doesn't use it. I think those people will still see that he generated a truly important debate, and I'm reluctant. I think maybe the Pulitzer could push some in the direction that what he did was good for society, but I think in a lot of ways people may have already have their minds made up.
Mm-hmm. Well, some would also say that the heroes in the story are the journalists themselves. Could you talk a little bit about what challenges and maybe even threats the journalists face when they're up against the story that they might feel obligated to report on, but also are being pressured not to?
Right. I mean, this is one of the most challenging stories in some time, just even from the initial contact with the source, Edward Snowden. He started trying to reach a couple journalists that he felt were really passionate advocates of civil liberties and really cared about the issues that he cared about. He started in January of 2013 trying to reach Glenn Greenwald, who was in with The Guardian, and Laura Poitras, who is a filmmaker, a freelance filmmaker, and who has done work on the NSA and has covered issues like war and surveillance. And so initially he had trouble even reaching Glenn Greenwald because Snowden would only communicate through encrypted communications, and that's something Glenn Greenwald didn't have set up in his computer. So even the initial contacts took a couple months to kind of get the ball rolling here back a little over a year ago. And then Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and the Washington bureau chief from The Guardian, Ewan McCaskill, then had to fly to Hong Kong to meet this source. They didn't know what he looked like. They didn't know if this was some sort of trap. They didn't know what the situation was going to be. And they met Snowden in Hong Kong, you know, got documents from him, and he, you know, revealed himself, and it became an international story overnight. And just in the reporting of this story, you have several journalists dispersed around the world. Glenn Greenwald lives in Rio de Janeiro. Laura Poitras is based in Berlin. The Guardian, which is where Greenwald was working, is based primarily in the UK, but also has a large newsroom now in New York City as well. And so there was a lot of moving parts here in terms of journalists trying to report out this story from several different countries at one time. And probably the biggest threat was not in the U.S., but in the U.K. The U.K. doesn't have the same sort of precedent for guaranteeing a free press that we have here in the U.S., and the U.K. authorities really cracked down on The Guardian in London, and at one point in time even compelled their editors to break their hard drive, to smash the computer hard drives that had the Snowden documents. Now, I mean, it was sort of a symbolic moment in this whole story because the documents were now dispersed around the world, and, you know, the documents aren't physically on a computer. They're, you know, uploaded and able to be accessed in all sorts of other ways. So, you know, it was a pretty incredible story because it brought to mind the Pentagon paper story in the U.S. during the Vietnam War, and you know, where a government tried to suppress the ongoing publication of state secrets. And, you know, it's as much as it's a national security story, it's also a journalism and a media story.
Mm-hmm. How do you think this will change the public demand for this type of journalism, these exposés or a challenge against government operation and surveillance?
Well, it's been a tough time because even outside of the Snowden documents, the Obama administration has been especially tough on leaks. They've cracked down more on leaks than any recent administration in terms of invoking the Espionage Act, which they used against Edward Snowden, and they've used more than all other U.S. presidential administrations combined. So, I mean, there is this climate where journalists will say that there's a chill in investigative reporting, but you see that there still is a hunger to get this type of information out there right now with the CIA's the CIA torture report, which is currently is being redacted, and some small part of it, maybe 10% of it, may actually be see the light of day. You have McClatchy, for instance, just last week, the Senate Intelligence Committee saying that they wanted to investigate a leak that went to McClatchy to reveal what was in this major study about the use of sort of what some call enhanced interrogation techniques, or some see as torture, mm-hmm. during the Bush years. So, you know, there are a lot of documents in there that journalists think are in the public interest and should see the light of day. And hopefully we'll see some more leaks, not reckless leaks, but leaks from people who feel that certain information should be out there and shouldn't be kept under lock and key.
Sure. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
That was Michael Calderon, senior media reporter at The Huffington Post. It's been more than a decade since the United States began fighting in Afghanistan in 2001. If all goes according to plan, the U.S. mission in the country will be over by the end of the year, making it America's longest war.
Now is a crucial time for Afghanistan. Earlier this month, 7 million Afghans headed to the polls in what marked the country's first democratic transfer of presidential power. 59% of the electorate made it to the polls despite threats and violence from the Taliban. Results now show close results with the likely runoff.
During the past three decades, Afghanistan has become a country used to transitions, from the Soviet invasion in 1979 to the rise of the Taliban to the American and NATO invasion.
Qais Akbar Omar tells the story of Afghanistan's turmoil from a personal angle in his memoir, A Fort of Nine Towers, an Afghan family story. His popular memoir was released earlier this month in paperback. Qais, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So the story of your family has a lot in common with the story of Afghanistan itself. What are some of the regime changes that you've lived through?
Well, in the West, mostly people know about the Taliban, and they don't know much about what Afghanistan went through before the Taliban came to power, which we had 4.5 years of civil war. And during that time, it's hard to get accurate number, but the number we get is like 2.6 million people were killed, innocent people, at that time. And my book is pretty much talks about that time. And I wrote the whole book written from the point of view of a child, how he sees things and how his world shifts. And pretty much two-thirds of the book is focused on that time, and then the arrival of the Taliban, and then the American. Basically, it's a story of one family, how to survive during those 4.5 years.
And your story begins in an Afghanistan that sounds at odds with the country that we see on the news today in America. It was a place that was full of beauty. Can you describe that Afghanistan of your childhood?
Yeah, well, Afghanistan is not always like what you have today. Now at the moment, as soon as you hear the word Afghanistan, people think of the bloodshed, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, all of those horrible and negative things happening there. But before that, Afghanistan was a very, very nice and beautiful place. I remember when my mother went to bank and she used to wear short skirts, and my father he was a boxer and he used to wear bell-bottom trousers, and he had sideburns, and the streets were full of trees, and they made arch on both sides, and schools were so good, and people were so nice and educated. And the problem is, what has always been thrust on Afghanistan, at the moment people think that Afghans probably are the warriors, but they are not. They are just people of culture and custom. And I remember that my uncle and aunts used to sit, we all sit around a candle at night. We'll turn off the TV and the lights, and we recite poetry, and it will last from 1 hour to several hours. And I recite, for example, 2 verses from Rumi, and my aunt or my uncle will recite to fight me back with 2 verses by Omar Khayyam or Hafez or Saadi, and this would go on for 3-4 hours. And the storytelling, another thing, and we all used to live in a one big nice courtyard, which 50, 60 people all sat around one tablecloth, and every night was like a party.
And you describe a family life that was prosperous and happy. When did you finally realize that it wasn't safe and you had to find refuge somewhere outside of the family home?
Yeah, well, you know, when Russia came in Afghanistan in 1979, at the time, Kabul was, I was not even born. I was born 3 years later. And even when I was 4 or 5 years old, Kabul was relatively peaceful because the Russians kept Kabul very calm. And they built roads and they built nice buildings all over the place. And but out in the countryside, if they found one person opposing to them, they will just go and bomb the whole village and kill thousands of people. And as a result, a large number of Afghans migrated to Pakistan and Iran, where they were farmed, and some factions were farmed in Pakistan by Americans, and they came and fought the Russians. And so when the Russians were defeated, these seven factions, when they came, my grandfather was very, very hopeful that now Afghanistan is in the hands of our own people and they will do a good job. So when these people came for the 6-7 months, Kabul was very nice and peaceful, and people could travel anywhere in the country, no problem. And after 5-6 months, since these people did not have any experience of how to run the country, each faction wanted to be the next president or the next prime minister or minister of defense. And then they had so much money and weapon already from Americans and some other countries. They start fighting each other, and as a result, we had 4.5 years of civil war. So, and at the time, I was 9 years old when civil war happened, and slowly, that beautiful world before our eyes just changed into hell. And from then on, we didn't see a single day of happiness. We had to leave our house, Kabul, to cross the border to go to Uzbekistan or Tajikistan, and from there to Italy. That was the plan. So everywhere we went, civil war chased us, and to a point that we had to go and live in the head of the Buddha in Bamiyan Valley in the central Afghanistan, where the statues of Buddha that were exploited by the Taliban. We lived there in the cave for 2 months.
And you had so many experiences. It's an incredible story. I want to fast forward a little and get us up to date on what's happening now. As we mentioned, Afghanistan is again in transition with its first democratic transfer of power and the end of the United States war there. What are your biggest concerns and your hopes for your country now?
Well, my hope is that everybody was saying that, oh, the Taliban is going to disrupt the election and they're not going to let this happen. Great success. That's all I can say now. And I'm saying that with a lot of pride. My family, my friends, my countrymen, everybody went to the polling centers and voted. And it was a great day, that election day, that Taliban warned that they are going to bomb every polling center. And they couldn't do a single thing. So everybody, a large number of people went and voted. And even those people who couldn't, who didn't vote or didn't have cards to go and vote, they probably went out and dipped their finger, their index finger, into the bottles of ink and went around and pointed their fingers at that, oh, we voted. So it was like a celebration, a very, very great day. So people were very happy, and as a result, there's a great hope that we will have the next president and who will be a better person. But at the same time, the big concern is that the Taliban are still there, so you have to just you have to be hopeful, but at the same time you have to understand the reality. The seven factions who caused 4.5 years of civil war, they are still running the country. And all these groups, and then you have the local warlords, and then you have the drug lords, and then you have those kidnapping groups and gangsters, all of those people. They have more money and weapons than ever. And as soon as Americans they were talking for a while about the zero option, which was not a very good idea, because as soon as they pull out, history will be repeated in Afghanistan, exactly what happened when the Russians pull out of Afghanistan.
And I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We're out of time. Qais, thank you so much for joining us today. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Qais Akbar Omar about Afghanistan's history as it makes its first democratic transition of presidential power. His memoir is called A Fort of Nine Towers, and it came out earlier this month in paperback.